It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the moral hazards of pinball and video games. Our guest traces the history of game panics in the United States.
First, last September's Wisconsin State Assembly put together a special task force to assess the challenges facing rural schools in the state.
Speaker Robin Voss asked for recommendations on handling things like declining enrollment, meeting transportation needs, creating partnerships between schools, and sharing innovations.
That report is now out, and the chairman of the task force, Representative Rob Swearingen from Rhinelander, is here with us to talk about it. Representative Swearingen, welcome to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation.
Can you tell us a bit about how this task force came about?
You bet. This goes back, just after we were elected into office, so a year ago, about February or March, and I got together with Representative Mary Chaya from the 35th Assembly District, and she represents the Tomahawk and Merrill area. And we were discussing the challenges that our schools and our respective areas are going through. And at that point, there were some very divisive referendums going on, specifically in the Rhinelander area and Tomahawk Merrill area as well. And so the two of us got together and made an appointment to see Governor Walker. And we talked with the governor and expressed our concerns over the challenges that rural schools were facing. And he agreed that there were some differences between rural and urban, obviously. And so we decided to follow up. And what I did was I invited several people from my home school district from Rhinelander down to Madison. So I had the superintendent, I had the president of the school board, along with some business people from the area. And we went on kind of a whirlwind meeting tour of the state capitol, met with the head of the education committee, met with several senators, met with the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. And at the time, we were talking specifically about the numbers relating to Rhinelander, but obviously it goes much bigger than just my home school district. The last meeting that day we had was with Speaker Robin Voss, and the group sat down with the speaker, and we laid out the problems we were having here in the north, and he agreed that we should set up some sort of a focus group, and ultimately, to his credit, he set up the Rural Schools Task Force.
And the list now is complete. A bunch of recommendations here for rural schools dealing with the challenges that face rural schools. What would you say are among the most pressing concerns, and how are you planning on addressing them?
Well, those are the million-dollar question is how we're going to address them. But the concerns, as we traveled the state, we toured 12 different rural schools. We had six hearings. Along with a seventh hearing inside the Capitol to welcome people in the education field to talk to us. And ultimately, the report that I issued a couple of weeks ago now, I guess, is a compilation of all the testimony that we heard from the superintendents, from the concerned parents and the taxpayers, from the teachers and WEAC and the teacher librarians. And the final report, what I put in here, is what I believe could possibly get some potential traction either in separate legislation or potentially in the budget in the next cycle. Some of the things that we identified were obviously when you get into the rural area, broadband access or broadband connectivity is a huge issue for us, and not only just with rural schools because it goes beyond rural schools. It also goes into economic development of these areas. But I always use Eagle River as an example of broadband. In the school, a lot of these kids stay after school and use the facilities in the library because scarcely 5 miles from the Northland Pines High School in Eagle River, some of these students are actually back on dial-up connectivity, which is just unacceptable for any sort of download that you may have to do with schoolwork after school, obviously.
And another thing, aside from the broadband, grade sharing is another recommendation that you have floated. How would that work?
Yeah, that's a neat idea. And it comes out of some great discussion that we had both with the Rural Schools Alliance and others. So you could take two respective school districts. Let's say they're within a reasonable amount apart, so 10, 20 miles apart. And what you could do is take students from, let's say, grades 3, 4, and 5, from both communities and transport them to one school, and then grades 6, 7, and 8 could go to the next school or up through 12 or however you wanted to lay it out. So you would have to come up with some sort of contract between the two districts. But ultimately what it does is instead of consolidating schools or the fear of shutting down schools or declining enrollment, you have students from that radius half going to one side and half going to the other.
Now, I want to talk about one of the recommendations that's been a bit controversial, and this was the suggestion to relax teacher licensing requirements so that I guess you'd have a broader pool of people who are interested in working and qualified to work at some of these rural schools. Why that suggestion?
Yeah, interesting to note, too, and that came out of some discussion. I believe it was with the teacher librarians. We had one librarian in the Antigo area that was really quite impressive. And I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek because she actually covers 9 school libraries in her job, and obviously spreading herself very thin. And along those lines, there was many teachers that are actually doing the work of 2 or 3 teachers or in different studies. And so the suggestion came out that they really need to cut back on some of the red tape and allow these people who already have the experience to maybe get a license, maybe perhaps a little bit easier. And this wouldn't go into all areas of the state. I don't expect it. It would go just to these, you know, maybe these rural schools. And this is just a concept, an idea. I know that it's been a little bit controversial, but I think that's a good thing. It gets people talking. And there certainly hasn't been anything introduced at this point, but it's an idea.
Yeah, we had a representative, State Superintendent, Tony Eaver, saying that he didn't think this would really address the problem, really get at what the problem was there. Do you have a thought on that?
I guess I understand where he's coming from. But here again, after 12 different hearings and people testifying, this was one of the things that that they thought might be something we should take a look at. Whether or not it gets any traction, whether or not we can come up with an idea that both sides can agree on, all remains to be seen. But I think that it deserves to be put on the table, at least for some good discussion.
Now, there were a couple of recommendations in the report that were voted down by the legislature already, including a loan forgiveness program for teachers and eliminating the cap on scarcity aid for schools. Could you talk about where those are now?
Yeah, sure. And actually, my co-chair was Representative Fred Clark, the Democrat out of Baraboo, who we worked really well together, along with the rest of the team on both sides of the aisle on this project. And Representative Clark did at one point introduce some legislation that actually removed the cap on sparsity aid. But that is a very, very expensive proposition to just blow the cap off of sparsity aid. So the proposal in the report simply raises it from $725 to $1,000, and then there's also an additional multiplier outside of that for some other possibilities with students. I think it's under 7 per square mile. So there are 2 different things we're talking about there. The other one was the teacher loan forgiveness. You know, here again, it was an idea that was placed on table. I wanted to make sure that the report was out first before I weighed in on any sort of proposed legislation. I believe that legislation also was not quite as cut and dry. And it's an idea. I think it merits some good discussion and further looking at. But that particular one, I'm not quite sure. I think that was actually tied to some sparsity aid as well. So there are options and there are ideas. You're right. There was a couple of pulling motions on the assembly floor that did not go anywhere on those 2 issues, but they are clearly in the report and something that should be looked at in the future.
So we've got a whole bunch of recommendations from this report. How big a priority do you see this being in the next session?
Well, like I indicated earlier, I think that what are included in this report is something that I believe we could potentially get some traction. I think that we've got the attention of the speaker, of course, and the assembly. Keep in mind, this was just an assembly task force. We still have to worry about working with the Senate. Obviously, we're hoping that they'll be receptive, and as well as the governor's office with everything's coming down the pike. But I do believe it's a priority. And what we found largely is these schools and these rural communities are the pride and joy of the community. And so there wasn't much talk about consolidation, for instance. I mean, maybe it could be there in the background of some of these folks, but they want to keep their schools. Same with the schools and their school libraries are very much a nucleus of the community, and that we need to save that in the state of Wisconsin as much we can.
Now, whatever happens, it's going to be a little while until some of these kick in. Do you think the rural school districts that are most troubled are going to be able to hang on until they get help?
Gosh, I sure hope so. But you are exactly right. You know, we won't go back in now until after elections, and so 2015. So all eyes are certainly on the next budget cycle and in standalone legislation to see what we can get done. But the fact of the matter is that I give the speaker credit for organizing this task force, and it was never on the calendar to be done prior to the end of session because we wanted to give it the time it deserved. It's a big project. It's a priority project. And I think what we have here is a pretty good snapshot of the end result. And so hopefully we can produce some positive legislation that will impact these rural school districts.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today to talk about it.
You bet. My pleasure. I appreciate the invitation.
We've been speaking with Representative Rob Swearingen from Rhinelander. He chaired a special task force that assessed the challenges facing rural schools in Wisconsin. From pinball to online poker and years of video games along the way, there's been fear about the impact these games have had on American kids.
From addiction to moral corruption, our guest says those fears have led to a series of game panics and alarmed parents, and in some cases led to games being banned or restricted. Jesse Walker joins us now. He's a books editor at Reason Magazine and Reason.com. His piece, A Short History of Game Panics, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. He's also the author of The United States of Paranoia, which he joined us a while back to talk about. Jesse, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, your story about video games actually starts before video games in the early days of pinball. What were people worried about in the pinball parlors?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I was sort of getting at there is that, you know, before there were video arcades, there still were the classic penny arcades, you know, and a lot of the anxieties that people had about video arcades, video game arcades, when they came along, had been around for, you know, going back to the beginning of the 20th century.
And we're losing Jesse's phone line there. It sounded kind of bad. We'll try to make a connection with him. In the meantime, you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know, were you a pinball fan? Are you a video game fan? Maybe in the absence of the guest, we'll ask you to call in and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did you ever get banned from playing video games on your consoles, your computer, at the video arcade? 800-642-1234.
Curious about what your experiences are. There have always been fears with new technology and new games. Come fears that it's going to corrupt youth. They will spend all their time doing this. They will not do their schoolwork. And you know, maybe sometimes there are psychiatric problems that are bundled into that paranoia. And all around games, we're curious about why that is. Did you ever get really into a game, maybe scared yourself a little, or do you think it's just fun to get into games, and that's sort of the whole point, and then we can take care of it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
And there have always been worries, too, about violence, especially in the age of video games. 800-642-1234. Do you see a link between video game use, video game consumption, and violence among kids? As we try to get our guest back, Jesse Walker with Reason Magazine, asking for your input on the topic we were going to talk about. Is there a downside to video games, video game addiction? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And actually, somebody had posted on the Central Time Facebook page, don't forget about Dungeons & Dragons and fears about that. And our guest actually referenced the movie Mazes and Monsters with Tom Hanks that was part of that concern about corruption, Dungeons & Dragons. We've got Jesse Walker back with us now. Jesse, hi.
Hi, how far did I get before we got cut off before?
You're starting to talk about pinball machines. Let's pick up at what were people worried that pinball machines would do to youth in particular, and video game arcades for that matter?
Well, I mean, with pinball specifically, people were concerned about gambling. I mean, they were used as gambling devices, especially the early models didn't have flippers, although a lot of them, it wasn't a pure game of chance. You could still jostle and push the machine to try to keep the ball going, depending on which kind of machine they used. But beyond that, it was the fact that these pinball machines were in arcades. I mean, in the old penny arcade, it was seen as this threatening environment. You know, sort of older middle-class people saw it as this place filled with working-class immigrants and young people. There were all sorts of rumors about the stuff that went on then, you know, even ideas like girls being kidnapped into white slavery, but not even just the extreme stuff like that, but people, you know, worrying about crime and delinquency. And a lot of those same old concerns came back when the video game arcades started to arrive in the 1970s and 80s.
And so let's talk about those video games now. Worries about people, kids being out unattended, playing these video games, and what, getting involved in unsavory activities?
Yeah, I found this great article in the New York Times from 1982 where there's a Long Island mother was crusading against video game arcades. And the phrases she used was that they mesmerize our children, addict them, teach gambling, and breed aggressive behavior. So you can hear the traces of the things people said about the old arcades, and you can hear sort of a foretaste of the things that people talk about video games doing now, the idea that they're addictive, the idea that people can be drawn into these worlds and imitate the aggressive behavior that they see there.
There has been some research moving on to those video games and to computer and console games. Some psychological researchers saying, maybe can't draw a straight line from playing, say, Grand Theft Auto and immediately, committing an act of violence, but finding a rise in aggressiveness for younger people playing these games. Is there some real worry there?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different issues there. One is, do games have an impact on people at all? Obviously, like any form of culture, they do. People read books, they watch movies, watch TVs, and, these are created to have, emotional or intellectual impacts as people watch them. And, it's not surprising that in these psychological studies done in a lab environment where they show somebody a violent piece of entertainment and then ask if they're more likely to punch a doll, maybe they are right afterwards. I'm not sure what kind of broader conclusions you can really draw from that. But in terms of actually when people have gone out into the world of gamers and looked at them in their own ethos, their own culture or subculture and see how the behavior carries over, there's really no sign that this is associated with greater social aggressiveness. I mean, violent crime has been declining over the time that video games have really taken off. I don't think that one caused the other, but I think it's kind of hard to make the case that video games have been working against that trend.
Well, let's take a caller now. We've got Kelly on the line in Cumberland. Kelly, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. And I apologize for my voice.
I'm getting there, too. Allergy season.
I have a tween son who loves, he's got an Xbox, and he loves to play games. One of his favorites is Call of Duty. And I have noticed as I have listened to him and watched him play this game, he plays with groups a lot. And I find it interesting how well they work together. They work together as a team to accomplish a goal. And there's no, I don't see any increased violence in him.
Gotcha. Kelly, we don't have much time, and I want to get Jessie in to respond to that. So she sees a mom here says no increased violence and maybe valuable lessons in cooperating now that you can play these games online with lots of others.
Yeah, but that actually gets to another thing about video games. And often they're sort of discussed as though they're isolating, as though somebody is just in the basement playing this by himself, never getting out. I mean, I'm sure there are people who fit that stereotype, but it's important to understand how often they are social activities and cooperation is a part of, just the gameplay.
And you write in your piece about efforts over the years, including in Congress, to restrict some of these games in some ways, especially Senator Joseph Lieberman. How do you see his role in these games? Did it have an impact on the games that were out there?
Yeah, I mean, well, this was at the end of 1993, so just over 20 years ago. Joe Lieberman and Byron Dorgan and Herb Kohl were the three senators who had these hearings on the alleged impact of video games on in terms of encouraging violence and untoward sexual behavior and so on. One effect of this hearing, by the way, is they found this really obscure video game with a sort of violence against women scene in it, and they made it better known so more people went out and got it, which I think was probably the reverse of the impact they wanted to have. But at any rate, Lieberman and Cole were very overt about the fact that, I mean, Cole said this directly, if you don't do something about this, we will. And the reason why the first video games rating systems were adopted by the industry itself was because they were directly threatened by the senators saying that we will create a rating system if you don't. And some people will say, well, that's great. It increases the amount of information that's out there. But I am of the opinion that, rating systems are not a very useful way of getting across the information people want to know about what might be offensive or inappropriate in a game. I think that you know, the sorts of labeling that's useful to me as a parent, you know, I mean, my kids aren't into video games, so I'm like about movies and so on, has to do with what specifically is in the content that they might not like or that, you know, might scare them or what have you. And just sort of squeezing that into one of these sort of broad, you know, what level of maturity ratings is not very useful. And I think Congress, you know, sort of pushed them in that direction.
We'll leave it there for now. Jesse, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Jesse Walker with Reason Magazine. We have his piece on gaming and moral panics linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Earlier this month, the state released an annual report on state tourism. The new numbers show that most tourists in Wisconsin are actually from Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you think most Wisconsinites stay in the Badger State for vacation? Do you do that? Do you stay in Wisconsin when you have a vacation? And what is your favorite tourist destination here in the state? And why? What do you like about it? Where are you planning to travel this summer in Wisconsin? And what do you think Wisconsin can do to market our state to other parts of the country, if you think we need to do that at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike Ivey joins us now in the studio. He's a business reporter for the Capital Times, where he's covered this this story. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So generally speaking, was this good news in this annual report on Wisconsin tourism from an economic perspective?
Oh, yeah. It showed that tourism spending, as the way they counted, is up, was up about 4% from last year. They stuck a number on there. The report says tourists spent about $10 billion in Wisconsin last year, and considering the whole state's GDP, all the goods and services in the state are about $260 billion. It's not an insignificant number to put out there.
And according to the report, most tourists in Wisconsin are actually from Wisconsin. Why are we counting the locals as tourists here? How does that work?
Yeah, that's always an interesting question when they put these reports together. Tourism, the way it's counted, is anyone acting out of their normal activity. So if you go to a movie, if you go out to eat at a different restaurant, if you travel anywhere outside your quote normal daily activity, that's actually counted as a tourism visit. So the numbers do get bumped up a little bit. The people that write the reports like to bump the numbers up because the people that pay for the reports like to see a big fat number. But I'm not sure everybody understands how those things are really counted, but any visit. So if I go to a Friday fish fry at the corner bar, I guess if that's out of my normal routine, maybe it's a new spot I went to, they'll count that as a tourism visit. Then they have a multiplier that they apply to. But a lot of it's based on hotel room stays, spending at the different water parks, tourism exhibits. So that's really how those numbers are put together.
So as we mentioned, most of the visitors from Wisconsin, and then the top states are, no surprise, our neighbors, Northern Illinois, Twin Cities, Michigan, Iowa. We're kind of a regionally focused tourism destination, it sounds like.
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, Rob, about only 19% of, actually 48% of people making overnight stays in Wisconsin were actually from Wisconsin. And if you look at what would be called foreign tourists, then this is anyone who's not from the U.S. and Canada would be included. That's only about 6% of our total visitors. So we're not really a big, what I would term, global tourism draw. And probably most of those people are from Canada and Mexico are coming here anyway. With that said, I'm not sure the tourism industry really cares so much about drawing people from outside the region and the country. I mean, a dollar is a dollar. Whether that person's coming from Minnesota or Illinois or maybe coming from Norway and Germany to visit, you know, people that have, who have settled here from there. The one advantage of drawing in outside money is that you are bringing new money into the economy. So you could say, well, if it's Wisconsin dollars, you're recirculating them. But I think if you own a bar or a restaurant or a hotel or work at a water park, you're just happy to see customers.
Now, there are some hot spots in terms of county destinations. Milwaukee is one, Dane another, Waukesha, Brown County, and Sauk County. Now, these are outliers. These are getting a lot of tourist hits. What's drawing people to those areas?
Well, if you look at the top 10 counties for tourism spending, the top three are the top largest counties in the state. So Milwaukee, Dane, and Sauk are 1, 2, and 3. Milwaukee, Dane, and Brown would be the top. Sauk slips into there because that's Wisconsin Dells.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just looking down the stats here of the top 10 counties. Most of them are the larger counties. That's just because there are more people there spending money. Milwaukee, obviously, you have everything from all the sports teams there, big art museum. Business trips count as tourism, so if you're having a big business event, for example, the Epic Systems user group meeting in Dane County, that's now one of the largest tourism events in Dane County. It's rivaling the World Dairy Expo. So maybe that says something about Wisconsin's changing economy if the tech conference is now rivaling the Dairy Expo as the biggest event. But, yeah, those business meetings help pad the numbers, too.
So for tourism promotion in the state, especially the State Department of Tourism, what's their focus? Are they trying to get more business conventions? I mean, we're not blanketing Uzbekistan with Travel Wisconsin ads, but where are they putting their efforts?
I think, like most of the Midwestern states, they're all sort of competing for Midwestern visitors. So you maybe don't see as many of the Wisconsin tourism ads here as you might see in Minneapolis is a good market. Chicago area is one of the strongest markets historically. Michigan tends to be a pretty good draw. Iowa's right in there. So that's where they target those ads. It's kind of funny. You travel around and you hear the other states' ads. I see Minnesota's ads here all the time. So spring is the time when they drop the tourism ads on everybody.
Yeah, I don't think you looked at this, Mike, but I'm curious, you know, if the same is true of our neighboring states, you know, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, that most of their tourist dollars are coming from in-state, too. Or do we just, in Wisconsin, do we just have an incredibly rich state with lots of places to go?
Well, it may be some of that. Maybe people here don't have enough money to travel outside the state. But I think Michigan and Minnesota would probably see a lot of the similar numbers. I would imagine California would. You know, if you lived in California, you would stay there on vacation. That might be a good follow-up at some point, Veronica. I could look at where travelers are and where they go. I mean, globally, tourism and travel is a huge industry. And as the becomes easier to fly and people around the world have more money and mobility, it all feeds into itself. And you know, travel and tourism is a great rich enhancer of life that I think a lot of people, if they have the money to do it, really do enjoy spending their time. And if you stay close to home, you don't have to, you know, take a big expensive plane flight somewhere.
Well, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite place to go when you are a tourist in the state of Wisconsin? And is there something that you think we should be telling the rest of the region, the country, maybe the world about that might bring them in to check out our state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Richard to start us off. He's in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hi. Well, some of the favorite things we've always liked to do, and we've always pretty much stayed in Wisconsin to do it, and that's everything from boating to sporting events to watching our kids play hockey and all that stuff during the winter. But we got into motorcycling here a few years ago in our early 70s, and there isn't any state that I have ever visited that I can remember that is much prettier than Wisconsin as far as in the summertime. The North Shore of Lake Superior and all along that South Shore around Bayfield, the Hayward Lakes area, you can go out for maybe 2 or 3 days at a time, be within a few hours of some of the greatest scenery and people and restaurants that I would think of. There is any place.
And Richard, if somebody has just a couple hours to take the best motorcycle ride in Wisconsin, where would you point them toward?
I think probably the Great River Road. That would be number one.
Beautiful.
Along the St. Croix would be right up there too.
Richard, thanks so much for the call. So yeah, that on the road tourism, Mike, is, I know I've heard a lot of people do that, whether in motorcycles, RVs, or just a old-fashioned car.
Yeah, I have seen I like to bicycle the back roads of Wisconsin. So I have seen a lot of motorcycle groups and motorcyclists. It's a very popular activity. I think it's something the state does try to promote. We've got, obviously have Harley here. And Wisconsin's road system, whether for bicycling, driving, or taking, you know, the motorcycle, is phenomenal. And get off those big roads and on the back roads, and there's always something kind of fun to see. I like to tell the story about bicycling in Dane County. We've got all these paved roads because they wanted to get the dairy trucks back into the farms. So Wisconsin went on this big push in the 30s and 40s to get its roads paved. And I think everybody probably appreciates that if you're a tourist.
Nice. Well, let's take another call here. We've got Taryn on the line from Onalaska. Hi, Taryn.
Hello.
Hi, what is your vote?
Well, my vote would be the Driftless region around the Kickapoo River, which is a wonderful, they call it the crookediest river in the world. It's a wonderful river to canoe or inner tube. And there's all sorts of other activities, including what the Kickapoo Valley Reserve has to offer.
What is that? What is the Kickapoo Valley Reserve?
It's like a huge natural park where you can go and hike and ride horses and bike ride, and it just seems to go on and on forever, and you see all sorts of wildlife, and I have to tell you, I moved here from Los Angeles.
Ah.
You can only imagine. I mean, when I moved my kids out here, they were like, and now what? You know, there's a lot of Amish, a lot of Amish farms, a lot of Amish goods that you can purchase, quilts and maple syrup and, you know, woodcrafting. And it's just... I used to think I'd died and gone to heaven when I got here just because it was just so beautiful and pristine.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. You're really making the case for the Driftless region there, Mike.
I took my son on the Kickapoo River last summer and we did a paddle trip, and it's just a really beautiful place to go, a spring-fed river. It's set up. You can just grab a canoe for about 3 hours and go. And I wanted to ask your caller if she was able to get her Californians to come out here and visit. Ooh. If she makes the pitch to them.
Taryn, you still there?
Yes.
Are you able to get your California friends out here? Do they want to come?
Well, you know, part of my problem is, you know, when you see something really beautiful, you want to share it, but at the same time, you don't want to inundate people because...
You don't want to bring Los Angeles to Wisconsin with you.
She wants to keep it to herself. Okay, there we go. Well, we're talking right now to Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times, about tourism here in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you think a lot of Wisconsinites, as we hear in a new report, stay in the Badger State for vacation? What is your favorite vacation spot? If you had to come up with an ad for Wisconsin, what things would you use to promote the state to people from outside Wisconsin? Get them to come here, spend some cash. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our conversation now about tourism in Wisconsin with business reporter Mike Ivey.
We want to hear from you. Why do you think most of our tourists are internal tourists, people from Wisconsin? Is there a favorite vacation destination that you love, that you recommend to other people, maybe that you think the state should use to market itself to people from outside the state? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go back to our phones now. We've got Paul on the line from Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I'm calling because I have a couple of grade school granddaughters visiting in July when school is out. And while I know about the Dells and the zoo in Madison, there's probably a lot of places within an hour or so's drive that they would enjoy visiting, but I have no idea about. If people have ideas, I'd like to hear about them, and I will listen on the air.
Well, before you go, Paul, are you thinking outdoor, you know, state park kind of destinations?
Sure, outdoor, exactly, yeah. Mostly outdoor, but... Or, for example, a gentle river to canoe would be one thing that I have in mind, and I don't know where I might find that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm going to toss this to you, Mike, because you are very much an out-and-about kind of guy. Where would you recommend for Paul?
I'm a big fan of Devil's Lake State Park. Just
hard to
go wrong.
Someone
hasn't been there before. It's so dramatic, and the views that you can get from some of the hiking. Now, it is pretty popular and gets some decent crowds. If I can put a plug in for one place, I'm a big fan of this Little America Amusement Park east of Madison. I think it's in Marshall. It's sort of a mini Knott's Berry Farm, for lack of a better term. It has a kid-sized ride, but it's pretty cheap. You could bring your lunch and hang out, and it's all locally owned. I like that place.
In that same vein, Circus World.
Circus World is another one that I've been to many times. In terms of good canoeing rivers, I think Kickapoo is a good one. People like the McCann River is fun. The Wisconsin River, in fact, is set up with a lot of different places that'll carry your boat for you, or even get it down to the river and shuttle it back and forth. You can camp on the sandbars, so there's plenty of options.
Devil's Lake might be a good option. It's got a rugged hike if you want. It's got a mellow hike around the lake, and you can get out in those paddle boats on the lake too. So you've got, you can cover a lot of ground. It's swimming if it's warm enough in
and
July.
And if you want to stay in Madison, you can rent boats on Lake Wingra, I know.
Yeah.
And other places too. Lots of little places for the local lakes. Well, good luck, Paul. I hope that helps, and maybe some other callers will give some suggestions as well as we move along here.
We've got Lynn on the line now in Kane County, Illinois. Am I reading that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Well, you're an outsider. You're down in Illinois. What do you like to check out here in Wisconsin?
Well, we have a lake home in Wisconsin,
okay.
In Washera County on Pleasant Lake, and it's a glacial lake, and it's absolutely beautiful. But one of the places that we have found, and you mentioned Baraboo, we just love that area. Also, just north of us in Coloma is the Crystal River. There's wonderful canoeing, kayaking, and they also have a great tour of the Crystal River kind of thing that goes around up there near King. So that would be something I'd recommend to the gentleman from Madison. It would only be like about an hour north. But we love to go to the winery, the Wollersheim Winery.
Great. Well, lots of great recommendations there, Lynn. Thanks, and enjoy your next visit to the lake house. Mike, you want to jump in? You were nodding at the Crystal River there.
Oh, there's so many great paddling opportunities. Maybe that's one thing that the tourism guys could do better here. I'm not sure how much we promote the outdoor stuff. I think they do quite a lot of that, but I see the water parks and more of the bricks and mortar places seem to get a lot of the love from the tourism people. I'm always curious on how big the market is for more of those nature-based activities. I know Michigan has got a big push on now with their parks doing more nature-based things. They've got they're doing a yoga class. They're doing things that might appeal to that crowd more than the traditional tourists. But I'm not an expert on it.
And we're talking about your favorite places to go in Wisconsin. We're talking Wisconsin tourism right now, looking at why most Wisconsinites choose to vacation here in Wisconsin. It's responsible for the bulk of our tourism numbers, and that means, you know, we got to like it here. There are things we love doing here in Wisconsin. We're taking your votes for the best things to do when you are vacationing, doing something special here in Wisconsin. Our number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get back to our callers now. We've got Alexis on the line in Milwaukee. Alexis, hi. What's your recommendation?
My recommendation, well, I'm from Milwaukee. I'm a city girl, but when I travel, typically it's just to Grandma's house, and she lives way up north next to the UP in Marinette, and I think that up there it's just great, and I thought it was super interesting that people typically stay in Wisconsin for vacationing, and when I heard those numbers, I was just shocked because I wouldn't have thought that counted as, like, tourism when people just go out of their way. But, I love, like, Oshkosh and places like that because I'm from the city. So seeing all that great nature, like, even just going down the highway, it's wonderful. And, yeah. And I think that people typically stay in Wisconsin because the people here are just so, like, welcoming and cozy. And Wisconsin just has such a great history where no matter where you go, there's something interesting to do, and the local people are just so great and wonderful, and I love it here, and I would never want to move from here, and I just hope that people from other states find us just as welcoming and great as we find ourselves.
Alexis, thank you so much for sharing that love of Wisconsin. You know, as she was talking, it made me think there's so many places in Wisconsin where you can go. Like, I was just in Sheboygan, and there's a little water park. And there was great food, and then not far there were a couple great state parks and museums in the area.
There.
I didn't go surfing, but you can combine a lot of different modes of tourism, you know, within a 20-minute radius of a lot of places.
Yeah,
Mike,
I got all excited earlier this spring. I did what I call the Wisconsin triple header. I got up in the morning. There was still some snow left at Elver Park, so I went over there and skied. Then I came back and took a bike ride with a few buddies of mine, and then I said, okay, I got to go for it, and I put the kayak in and paddled down Winger Creek right behind my house. So, I mean, it was kind of like California Light.
There's a triathlon in there somewhere.
A mini triathlon. All right, let's go back to the phones. Jeannie's joining us in Northbrook, Illinois. Hi there.
Hi, I'd just like to suggest the EAA Museum in Oshkosh, as well as the Big Fly-In. It's usually the last week of July or early August. And it's a fabulous international event, and you don't even really have to like aviation to enjoy it. There's so much history. It's just a really, really fabulous place. And now they have a Hall of Innovation, which has all kinds of new inventions, everything from electric skateboards to observational crafts and things that they're using in other parts of the world for all kinds of even philanthropic efforts. It's just there's something for everybody there.
Jeannie, isn't that museum open year-round? It's not just during the air show, right? So you can go up any time?
Right. The museum is open year-round, and it has a particularly great exhibits for kids when they're studying World War II. That whole era is so well represented there. There's even a simulator, like a ride that they couldn't even take at Great America. They get to create their own ride. And there's just so many ways that kids can be stimulated there.
Jeannie, thanks a lot for the call. You know, and that air show, I bet that might be an exception. I bet that brings in people from way more than just our region here, Mike.
That's got to be one of the biggest draws, I would think, for the valley, as it is. Mm-hmm.
And as we wrap up here, Mike, where are you going to vacation in Wisconsin this summer?
Well,
you going anywhere
I just
here?
Got back from Superior Falls, which is the Montreal River that separates the UP from Wisconsin. And I've been a lot of places in Wisconsin. I'd never hiked in around and seen this falls with while all the water pouring over this huge gorge. I mean, I was going to post some homemade video on my Twitter account, but I don't know if anybody'd watch it. But I'll probably go there. I'm going to take some bike rides. My dad lives in La Crosse. I love to bicycle over there. Phenomenal. And Milwaukee is, it was the number one tourist draw, but there is a lot of stuff to do in Milwaukee. Just exploring the neighborhoods there is a blast.
A lot of great ideas. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us again today. That was Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times.